This is a Pinball News production.
Yeah, I'd like to just say something about Dan Fonts, because he's been incredible at not only pointing us out towards the earlier machines, but actually finding one. There's a great machine here, and I was reluctant to bring it because I always want to hold something for next year, but and it didn't get loaded on the truck. But when I went the last load, I brought in this Expressway that he found, and I don't know where he found it, but it's an incredibly rare 1938. Is that exhibit? Is that exhibit?
Exhibit Skyrocket.
Exhibit Skyrocket, yeah. Which celebrates the bridge, the building of the Bay Bridge, the Oakland Bay Bridge, and the Golden Gate Bridge. And in the background is Treasure Island and the Pan Pacific Exposition, which was happening there. And there's a lady riding a giant skyrocket over it. And it just knocked my socks off when I saw that. And that's what Dan really brings, is an incredible talent of being able to sniff out these games. There's a list of games that he's found, and you go, "Oh, we got to get that." And I'm going, "I don't know, Dan." And then it shows up, and I'm just like, "Wow, this is incredible!" So, thanks, Dan.
And by the way, Dan is a very talented muralist, and he's responsible for many of the murals that you see painted, the larger than life back classes on the canvases in the back of the Expo against those black walls.
He was the originator he did the first majorettes, and it was just so cool that our first Expo had that majorettes there, and it was just like, it was so cool to have that. So
what we thought we'd do today is start by giving you some history about the evolution of what's actually led up to the current state of the Pacific Pinball Museum, then tell you about some of the milestones that we've achieved in the recent, say, 12 to 18 months, and then talk about what it is that we see as a vision for our future. But you really can't judge and gauge the future unless you've looked at the past. So for that, Mike's going to give an introduction of how this all got started.
Well, and there's Ed. Hi, Ed. But you guys have probably already heard this one before, but I'll just briefly run through it. This all started out as kind of an art project for me, where I had one pinball machine that was a Gulfstream, and that was I got that because I was playing computer pinball, and it just wasn't cutting it. I had an old Amiga with, it had three different computer pinball games on it. And I was having fun playing it, but after a while, it's just like, man, it just wasn't the same. And at that point, it was hard to find pinball. I forget when that was, but maybe I wasn't looking in the right places, but it definitely wasn't any electromechanical. And that's what I really wanted to play, because that's what I enjoyed playing. It was the 70s, early 70s EM. So I went freelance from the Exploratorium and quit my job, and I managed to rebuild my house and started getting income from renting it. So I bought about 36 games from a lady in Benicia, and I was going to retheme every one of them. I got duplicates and everything. And when it came down to it, I just couldn't put sandpaper to the play field. It just kind of was to me. The more I looked at it, the more I thought, well, this is kind of like chopping a Duesenberg. So I thought, well, maybe I should think twice about this. I'm really glad I did, because I said, well, I had them sitting there for a little bit, and I didn't even know that you could take the legs off and that the head came off. I had them all stored in my friend's warehouse, and to do that, I had to put in 4 days of just grueling labor to pay off the rent for a few months. And then at that point, I said, well, I don't want to do any more work for her, so I'm going to find a place to put these things. But I wanted them to be played. So I just did a crash course. That's where I got into Cliffy. He was as Shaggy, and I got his DVDs and learned about how to fix them. And I thought, if that idiot can do it, I guess I can too. So and so he was an incredible help for getting me started in this. What I did was I just rented a little room, and I put about 16 machines in there, and we opened up on New Year's Eve of 2002. And after that, it started out as a party, and I thought, well, I can afford rent for a few months. Let's just see where this goes. I'll put out a jar. People put $5 in. We'll see if we can keep this going. And I just did it on a Saturday night. And it kind of became this speakeasy club. And more and more people were coming. And then Jim Gruber came along, and he really dug what I was doing. I started teaching classes at the at the Crucible about how to work on these things and about electricity and kinetic art, the way I was looking at it. Eventually, I knew that the city was going to catch up with me, and I better do something, because they actually, in my town, pinball arcades are illegal, and I never even thought about that until many years later. I'll go back to that, but what happened was I thought, well, I'm going to have to prepare for the future. I better start working on a 501c3 plan, because I thought, you know, this is cool, and to keep it working, it's definitely, you know, there's a reason that they went out of business. It's obviously not going to survive on coins, because if it did, people would still be doing it. So I thought, well, the only way to do it is to free play them, do an admission, and go for a nonprofit status. And that was actually a lot harder than rebuilding an EM pinball machine. It's a lot of bullshit that you got to, a lot of hoops to jump through. But we did it, and with a little help from a lawyer and some donated time, it was all grassroots stuff. We got our 501c3 about the same time Tim Arnold got his. I'd been talking with Tim, and we were sharing information, and then he decided he was going to rent a building finally. And so we kind of became the 501c3 museums. Around, let's see, when was that? It was 2004, I guess. Yeah, we got our nonprofit status. And then at that point, I think what happened was a lot of people saw, hey, this is a cool thing, because they're obviously trying to just get the pinball out there. And so we got a lot of collectors and a lot of enthusiasts to come on board. And I think that's the real success of what we're doing is the whole pinball community support and input for the whole thing.
That's very true. And this year is a good example of that, because in the past 3 years we've been putting on this show, we basically tore apart the museum and brought 80 to 90 machines here. This year we decided to leave the museum intact, and because of the grassroots effort of the local collectors, we've more than made up that slack. This year we have more games than ever. I think we have 438 or something like that, last count.
I think so.
So it's not just...
Although some came in during the night, and we came in this morning and there's more machines. You know, how did that happen?
So yeah, in other words, the spirit and the volunteerism that exists here in the Bay Area is just off the charts. I mean, it just doesn't seem that way in either the Midwest or the East Coast. I really can't speak directly because we don't live there. But people we've talked to that are trying to establish and assemble and put together a similar type of venture, they don't seem to have that cohesiveness and spirit of cooperation that we do. So we're really fortunate.
It's the hippy-dippy Californians, I guess. I don't know. But that's true. And I think the other reason is that we kind of have a... It's not an arcade model museum. Our goal is trying to inspire an interest in art, science, and history through pinball. Because there's a few reasons for that. One is sustainability. We just don't believe that you can sustain a museum either by coin drop or even admission, and also, what are you doing? You're basically that's a nostalgic route that you're going down. And we want to think about the future and the kids, the generations that are going to be playing these games. We want to do more than just let them have fun. We want to educate them about science, art, and history. So we're trying to develop those themes into educational curriculum. It's also a way to make it more sustainable if we can get grants. And when you have three venues to go for, of science, art, and history, you basically tripled your chances of getting a grant. So that was our thinking in trying to establish a museum under those guidelines.
Pinball, more or less, is the golden carrot that gets people in the door. And if they're not careful, over a few hours, they'll learn something about all three of those disciplines, all under the same roof. And a lot of museums can't say that, I don't think. But what we don't want to be is, Mike, you mentioned Duesenberg's earlier, we don't want to be the model of an auto museum where the shiny chromed, you know, Duesenbergs are behind glass or behind velvet ropes that can't be touched, just look and appreciate. Because pinball and coin-op, I think amusement in general, is meant to be hands-on. It's meant to be interacted with, kinetic. We want to preserve that. As Mike said, treat the machines and the games with a certain sense of reverence that they deserve, and also make sure they have a relevance for the current generation and also future generations. That's really what we're trying to do. Not from a nostalgic point of view, although people of a certain age walk in and they say, I remember playing that when I was, you know, this age or this and that. Wow. And then you have the other end of the spectrum of young kids who've never even seen a pinball machine. They may have played one on the Wii or PlayStation or something. So there's that. But we really want to be, you know, there's a place for nostalgia. There's a place for today's and future generations of kids. But we also want to educate. And I think the term is edutainment, so educate and entertain at the same time. And what was the other one? Arcadium?
Arcadium.
Like arcade and museum combined.
I guess the point here is basically sustainability. And one model was the Exploratorium, which has a lot of hands-on interactive exhibits for education. And you take that model and combine it with something like the Oakland Museum and the Musée Mécanique was kind of like the three things that I was thinking of. And those were just places that I wanted to take people that visited San Francisco or the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. Those are three great things that really offered something unique. And I thought, well, it'd be cool to put them all in one place. And so that was another idea behind it. Where we're trying to go from here is, so far we've expanded the museum, and so we're offering about over 85 machines now, and we're open. We expanded our hours to 6 days a week. This allows people from all over to come, and instead of being open just on the weekends, they can now come in during the day. We're sustained in the sense that we're covering our rent and all the parts necessary and any outside services we need. We're still pretty much volunteer. We have to give a little bit of money to moi. I take $1,000 a month for about 60 hours a week work. So the next step is to staff it, try to raise funding for that. Our big movement is towards a place that combines the whole ball of wax. In other words, our warehouse facility in a restoration facility along with the museum and an educational center.
Yeah, we should back up just a little bit to give you an idea of the size of the museum's collection. We have over 650 pinball machines in various states of restoration and repair. And we've got, how many do you think we brought from the museum itself? 350 this year?
I think about 350.
And what we'd really like to have is a facility, a permanent home, that's twice as large as what you're seeing here in Marin City. This is a 22,000 square foot facility. We need 45 to maybe 50,000 square feet that would contain everything basically that you'd see in the Smithsonian in D.C. If you walked into the National Air and Space Museum, you'd expect to see an oral history section where you could listen to interviews from designers and artists who built these things, or historians or collectors. You'd expect to see a gift shop. You'd expect to see a restaurant, a restoration classroom facility, a storage area, and, of course, all the machines themselves, all set on free play, all under one roof. That's the vision that we have, is a space such as that. In San Francisco, currently, there's the Exploratorium at the Palace of Fine Arts. The Exploratorium is moving out of there in the mid to late 2012. That space currently is 200,000 square feet. The city of San Francisco is said they're going to carve that up into fourths or maybe fifths in that time frame. That would be ideal for us. We also have our eye on two other spaces nearby, but that by far would be the best in terms of a destination and a permanent home. Of course, rent is not going to be easy, but I think we might be able to make it up on volume because we would get the tourist element and demographic. We would certainly get the hardcore pinball enthusiast crowd. I think we'll get that no matter where we are. And we would get just locals and people who are interested in diversion and fun. And it's certainly a destination place now. And I think that's really where we need to be in the future. In terms of time frame, we're looking at 1 to maybe 3 years out. So it's not that far away. And along the way, we need to raise money, obviously, by putting on shows such as this. This is our one annual fundraiser. And as Mike said, we are sustainable in our current state, but we need more of an effort to be made on grant writing, foundation money, corporate donors, and the support and help of people like you that just spread the word about pinball, not necessarily our museum in particular, but pinball in general, to keep this the whole movement alive, that be ambassadors of pinball, as it were, to everyone you talk to. And that can only help.
Yeah. We could definitely use a grant writer. I wrote a National Science Foundation grant for informal science education, and that's the grant that the Exploratorium and all the interactive museums go for. And that was actually harder than doing the 501c3 paperwork. It was pretty intense, and I don't know if anybody was at Cal Extreme. I was working on it right up to the minute, and I was working with Molly Reisman, and she helped out a lot. It got reviewed, and it wasn't. They didn't want a full proposal. They just did an encourage or discourage. But they, even though they weren't recommending a full proposal, they all said you definitely should pursue this whole line because we think it's great. You just need to develop it more. So I guess we're spot on the money in terms of what we want to do with this the science education. It's a matter of developing the curriculum, developing it a little bit more, and it's a hard thing to do. The concept's pretty simple. You attract kids and adults. It really appeals to all ages through these amusement machines. When they play them, they will be trying to make a high score, and how they go about doing that, they'll have to do something like get a ball up to a certain thing, and in doing that they will be learning about a physical or scientific phenomenon, and at the end of them playing they start to realize like the effects of magnetism or a certain property of gravity or mass or vectors that you have to do. I know this sounds real vague, but a real brief example is we had a simple little thing. It's just a pinball coil with a little tiny ball. And we figured out that if you get up to a bumper switch and you tap it just right, you can get a pulse that will suck the ball up in there and then shoot it through the other side because of the initial, when you first energize it, it forms a magnet that sucks it into the coil. But if the pulse is just the right shape, the momentum lets the ball continue on through. And the idea was to make a little bell ringer, like, you know, you hit the hammer on the thing and ring the bell. So you got to hit it just right. And so they'll sit there and try to do it, and you try to get points or whatever by ringing the bell. And then you read about, like, what's going on, just like the Exploratorium exhibits. Another one would be, like, showing how a parabola works. We set up a little ball shooter into a rubber parabola, and no matter where you put the ball shooter, you're able to slide it back and forth, the ball always comes back to the same place. So it's describing how a parabola works. But it's all using pinball. And so we're trying to make it fun, and they play all these games, and then at the end they come out with a little bit of knowledge about how these things work. And we call it stealth learning because they don't really know that we're trying to like hide the education process in a game, and we think it could be a pretty powerful tool for educating people about science, technology, engineering, and math, and that's the buzzword for the National Science Foundation, and most of the curriculum use that's what they want to teach. And that's only in the science area. The history area, we haven't even touched. And there's grants available that for restoration of objects. And nobody's ever gone into that area. So it's prime time to do that. The art, I think that you don't even have to talk about that. It's pretty obvious. It's not only the graphic art, but the art of engineering a game that's fun to play. Nobody talks about that much in terms of, when you engineer something like that, if it's not fun, nobody's going to want to play it. And that's a real art that nobody ever, has dug into. So,
one thing about the science curriculum is, I'm sure you've all seen the ClearPin that's on the show at the show today. What we have in mind is to have that as the centerpiece of science exhibits and satellite around it seven or eight other smaller devices that could be in plexiglass squares to demonstrate various aspects of either electricity, electromagnetism, algebra, physics, whatever it happens to be, and either sell these to other exploratorium-type entities around the country or rent them out for periods of time. So that's part of our business model, and the next step obviously is to build these things. They're not cheap. How much does a clear pin cost?
Yeah, I keep getting that question. They're expensive. If you have to ask, you can't afford it. No. And again, this goes back to the sustainability. If we can set up a shop where we can not only restore machines for the museum, but also for other people, outside sources, that's one source of funding. Duplicate machines we could restore and sell. The same shop could be used to make exhibits for sale to other museums. And I've gone to a few of the Association of Science and Technology Centers, and they're kind of chomping at the bit, wanting some of these exhibits, but they need to be in a package and everything. That was what the NSF grant was all about. And they want to see it more developed. Like I said, we've developed the clear pinball, and we're going to do another one that's going to show the difference between electromechanical pinball and a solid-state pinball. They'll be side-by-side. It'll have the same machine. I think we're going to use a Freedom. Probably have to develop a few more exhibits before they get the concept. And a grant writer also would... it's really necessary. I mean, I'm an okay writer, but when it comes to science grants, they're very, very particular, and that's one thing that I got to admit we're really lacking on. But the whole idea is to be able to have all these income streams from various things that move the whole museum forward and develop a curriculum that allows us to go out either into field trips by developing another little juju mobile pinball museum and science education thing that will go out to the schools, because the schools are really hurting. I don't know how it is in the towns you live in, but in Alameda, which is generally considered a great place to send raise a family, have your kids, and they're hurting. And they're asking us. We've done a lot of school groups that come through, and we do a lot with Girls Incorporated, Boys and Girls Club, and a lot of the schools in Alameda. But the whole area is hurting for an accessible museum in our area that explains basic principles, and it could either go to a school or at least be open for them. And that's one area where we're really hurting, because we don't have the space. We have enough space to display all our machines, but we don't have enough space to set up the science exhibits. So
when we talk about field trips and young kids, we obviously have to be careful to not... be accused or guilty of corrupting today's youth and modern technology, because, let's face it, pinball has a very sort of a mixed or checkered past, as it were. And it wasn't always the kind of places and venues where your parents would want, as parents, you wouldn't want your kids hanging out where pinball was generally being played. It was either a smoky pool hall or a bar or a bowling alley or whatnot. And it's been said that pinball is the surest road to downward social mobility because of all the dimes and quarters and nickels that you'd have to break your piggy bank to play the darn things.
Oh, I used to beat up the kid next door to get the quarter. No.
So we it's kind of a fine line. It's a balancing act that you have to walk here. I mean, obviously, we don't want to, I mean,
corrupt our youth.
Or elevate them and put them up on a pedestal and say that, you know, these things are next best things since sliced bread. But, I mean, they have had a purpose in American culture, uniquely American culture. And I think what we're trying to see to it is that they remain, as I said, relevant and have a place as a teaching tool.
Yeah, it might seem a little funny what he's saying about, you know, pinball being risque, but I'm sure all of you read about Beacon, New York, and what happened with that little museum. He had a mainly electromechanical arcade and pinball museum, and it was an arcade model of a museum, and it was in a little tiny town in New York, Beacon, New York. And I don't know if it was a noise issue or somebody got a hair up their butt about it. And they looked up on in the local laws and said, hey, pinball is illegal in this town. So they shut them down. And it hit CNN. It made some big, major news waves.
Maybe a month ago.
Yeah, a couple months ago, I think. And everybody went, what? You know, pinball? You're shutting them down? It's illegal? And they, you know, everybody wrote the mayor and everything. They still shut him down, and he ended up selling all his stuff. It was kind of sad, but it reminded me of the fact that when I went to, you know, when we first expanded onto Webster Street, I said, well, we got to redo the awning and put our Pacific Pinball Museum, paint it up on there. So I got Ed Castles to say, okay, you can do it, and so the next step was, well, let's get a permit. You know, I guess, do we have to get a permit? Well, we went across and talked to the business district lady, and she said, well, yeah, you better get a permit for that, because we've been kind of, you know, underground for the most part. So I go down to City Hall, and I go, okay, we need a permit to paint Pacific Pinball Museum, and, you know, and we're a nonprofit, blah, 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 you love us. They go, oh, okay, well, let's look at that. And they just went, denied. You know, I went, what? You know, so I go back, and I go, well, they denied me, you know. Oh, well, we'll go back and talk to this person. So I went back and talked to that person. They go, well, what is it? And I go, well, it's a pinball museum. Well, what do you have in there? Well, pinball machines. She goes in the back, looks up, yeah, pinballs are illegal in Alameda. And I went. She went, pinball arcades are illegal. Not pinball machines, but pinball arcades. She goes, and I went, well, I've been there for 8 years, and, you know, I'm sorry to say, but I think you're wrong. So she goes and hauls out this big book, opens it up, right there, it's illegal. And I went, oh, crap. So I go back, and I go, well, okay, they're saying it's illegal. And, you know, we just repainted the whole thing, and we got the murals that Ed and Dan did, and what are we going to do? So, and sure enough, they were illegal. So, and I used the thing about, well, we don't do coin drop or anything, and that's what saved our butt, is because there's no legal way, and I knew this was going to work for us eventually, but that's what saved our butt, was the fact there's no coin drop. If there's no coin drop, it's not a coin-op amusement machine. So, but it was a little nervous over that weekend, because I didn't know what was going to happen when I went in on Monday. But I went in on Monday, and apparently the powers behind the scenes, you know, work their magic, and I went in there, and they went, oh, yes, sir, just right this way, just sign here, here's your permit. And I got 300, no, how much was it? It was, you know, $300 or $400 for the permit to paint over it. But it was a little dicey there, and it's amazing, it still has that stigma about it.
A couple of, we should talk about a couple of recent accomplishments, I think. Like,
yeah.
Maybe the San Francisco airport.
Yeah.
The San Francisco airport, for those of you who don't know, has a series of small museum cases out at the airport. There's about 17 of them, and they're a fully accredited museum. They have collections of toasters or tin toys or, you know, coffee pots or whatever it happens to be for months at a time. They approached us and said, would you be interested in putting 35 to maybe 40 pinballs behind glass, two 40-foot-long glass cases, and leave them there for, say, 6 months.
It was their main case right there in the international
airport. It's an international terminal. You don't need to be a ticketed passenger to see them. Sure, let's do it. That sounds great. So we did it from, what was it, November through
about... It took about a year to put it all together. I worked with Richard Conger and Larry and myself, Helmut Jort, and Stan Miller.
And we had
and
games,
so we supplied all the machines.
And we had games from the 20s, 30s, maybe even some Bagatelles from the late 1800s.
Yeah.
And all the way to today's solid state.
I think it went up to Adam's family. Yeah. And it was a real brief history of pinball. And they said it was the best show that they'd ever done in there. And then on top of that, we took in 8 pinball machines for 2 weeks. We'd haul them out. They made us keep them about kind of half a mile away. And so we had the pinball dollies. I had a couple of them. And we'd wheel them out into the main thing and do a around one of the columns.
Set on free play.
And it just knocked people's socks
off. There were lines 4, 5, 6 people deep. Yeah, they were putting foreign coins into them when we... a lot of them were foreign international travelers.
Yeah, and we were just saying, no, it's all on free play, you know. So they go, okay. And it was pretty exhausting. Larry did a shift or two, and I did a few shifts. And we all took turns. As board members, that's one thing that we require, is that you got to put in some time. And we staffed it for 2 weeks, and it was incredibly successful. And it got a little bit of press, but the thing that impressed me was people from all over the world knew how to play a pinball machine. The little kids didn't, but their parents would show them, and boy, they can beat the hell out of them just like we do. It was amazing. I mean, it was the international airport, so these people were from all over, and it was... It felt really good that we were not only, you know, spreading the pinball love, but we were going international on it.
And yeah, it was nice to know that their last thought of San Francisco is, before they get on the plane, was playing pinball.
Was right. The one sad thing was that a few of the people I asked, where do you think pinball came from? And they go, oh, it's European, isn't it? Which is kind of true. It did come from France, but I thought it was kind of sad that they didn't realize that America had, you know, developed this thing into what it was, what it's become. That it is an American icon, but I don't think we almost like hide it like a retarded uncle or something.
You know? That's true.
It's like, you know, and it's really something that we should be proud of. And that's another important part of our goal is, you know, putting a little pride back in what Americans can do. It's one. I always thought it was one of our greatest achievements. And people, you know, like, really? And yeah, really. When you think about it, what is it? It's like we have enough time and we've developed a culture that takes care of all its needs enough to the point where you can build a box that is for amusement only. And that's an interesting concept, I think.
And also, pinball doesn't have that lengthy of a history. I mean, if we're talking about being invented in, 1778, or electricity only being involved since the early 30s, flipper in 1947, you know, it's really not that old of a phenomenon. I guess one of the questions that we get asked all the time is, what are you guys going to do when, if and when, the last manufacturer of pinballs ever does go out of business? What becomes of pinball? Does it just die? Does it become extinct? Does it only survive in the memories of people who enjoyed playing these things over, you know, decades in their youth and misspent youth and misadulthood? The answer that we give, obviously, is that there's still people that make parts for games, and what we do primarily is restore and refurbish older machines, modern ones too, but I don't think we necessarily depend on the existence of brand new games being made, although it's nice to have the latest and greatest games. That I guess that's subject to a lot of debate, though. A lot of pretty strong ideas about that. We should probably open it up for questions and answers if you have anything we haven't touched on yet. One second, Randy. Yes.
I collect shoot boxes and trains and pinball machines, of course. But what I'm seeing in most hobbies is this decline in reproduction parts and reproduction manufacturers and parts availability for this stuff. Is that going on in pinball as well? I don't track it as
I can honestly tell you that pinball remanufactured and reproduced parts now is at its strongest point than it's ever been.
Yeah.
In terms of back glasses, plastics, of course, play fields being reproduced. Guys like Steve Young at Pinball Resource have been doing it for, I don't know, 30, 35 years now. There's other people that making coils, you know, flipper bats, and just about anything that you can think of that goes into these things. So I speaking of, in terms of just the parts that we receive from various manufacturers on a gratis basis, it's never been stronger.
Yeah, it's pretty strong.
For pinball.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Randy, you had one?
Well, you know, I know you guys would not turn down private donations, and I think one of the big motivators for me is when I'm able to see a little bit more specifics about how you're going to move forward, get a sense of what the numbers are going to be. I mean, I'm so excited about the location in San Francisco, you know, as a possibility. But I'd love to get just a wild idea of once you start putting some ballpark numbers together, what that's likely to cost, and where you're going to get your money, and how much money you're making now, and how much money this show generates. And so, you know, if I were to make a, I'm not talking about a $50 donation, I would have a sense of confidence, you know, that this is going to mean something and go somewhere.
Certainly. What we've done or tried to do is to approach people who have sizable donations to certainly open up our books, show you how profitable we are on an annual basis and on a monthly basis. And when Gordon Hossie, for example, donated over 200 of his Gottlieb wood rails to our collection, we shared with him everything that we take in and everything that we spend. I mean, it's only fair because he had the opportunity to donate those games on a permanent loan basis to several other entities in the world, and he chose us. But he did his due diligence, and we'd certainly let you and any other donors have access to our books and see.
How far away are you from maybe starting to get a sense of what it might cost to move into the Exploratorium facility?
We've talked with the Golden Gate Bridge Recreation.
And San Francisco Rec and Park divisions.
Yeah. And
right now they're taking names on a waiting list of people who have expressed interest to move in there. There are various business entities besides us that for profit.
As the higher the price becomes, no doubt.
I think that's the case.
There's
but we have had conversations. We can put it that way.
Yeah,
it's about as
we're looking for a little bit of help on their end because we feel like we've done a lot of work on our end. This would be an attraction. So meet us. I'm going to say halfway because I don't think they'd ever do that, but. You know, come towards us a little bit and let's work something out. This is something that would help everybody. And there's people in San Francisco that really want to see this happen.
And part of the due diligence process also for us to prove it is that we've proven the concept in Alameda that it works. Right?
We have been doing it for almost 9 years. And it's hard to attribute to it, but I'd take a guess and say that we've done an incredible amount to elevate pinball to a higher status. And if you look at what's happening around the country, it's becoming more popular. Just in, you find more and more news articles about pinball, and we want to keep the momentum going. But
there was an article in the Wall Street Journal within the last 3 weeks on pinball, how hard it is to find a pinball repairman. On page one, they usually have a human interest column at the very bottom of the front page. The New York Times is going to come out with an article probably about a month and a half, maybe 2 months, about pinball museums. They'll mention ours, but I think they're going to focus on Silver Ball Museum in Washington, D.C. So
yeah.
The interest is high, and we really want to strike while the iron is hot.
Yeah. I think what we truly have to do is more educational curriculum and really, really push that because I always looked at it as more of a entertainment thing at first, and it wasn't until we started doing the art shows that we got a lot of people coming, and that's what really set it off was getting a whole other group of people to look at this, and we put the pinball out, you know, in the early days. It was basically pinheads or people, the curious people. As soon as we started doing the art shows, all of a sudden a lot of San Francisco people started coming, and it became incredibly popular overnight, seriously. Just one article in the Chronicle about the art show around a pinball place, and it was packed. Jim and I just was like, we couldn't believe it. And so there's an incredible significance to offering the things outside of the actual games. That's really key. And that's what I think developing that, you know, has to be in place before we can even think of getting into a larger facility. And that's what I'm trying to concentrate on, is developing that end of it. I mean, we have the games and they're restored, or a lot of them are restored. We need to restore a lot of them, but we're lacking on the curriculum, you know.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Do you publicly announce how many people like attended this weekend and how profitable that is?
We try to, yeah. Our shortcomings are our website. We don't have a art director. We're all doing this in the seat of the pants, and I know that we're lacking our website and information that we need to get out there. It's just a lot to do. I could tell you if we were doing car washes, we'd make more money.
Oh, sure. Can you give us a hint as to like how many people are here this weekend?
Sure.
What
well,
that means for organization?
It's too early to tell this weekend, but I can tell you last year we brought in we drew 2,850.
Yeah.
Paid attendees. And that was from, if you look at the, on their way in to the show, look on the far left wall, just before the main doors, you can see maps on the wall with pins of places and countries and cities where people are from. It's mind-blowing. I mean, it's...
Sorry, how many did you say?
2,800 to almost 2,900 last year. The projections so far, people we've been talking to at the front door, that were slightly ahead of last year's pace.
Yeah.
And that's in a down economy, so... Yeah, and I think it's a function of how much advertising we've done, what kind of word of mouth, what kind of press we've gotten, and every year that we've done this, let's put it this way, we've become more and more profitable, almost by a factor of 50% every year now since 3 years ago, so we don't expect anything less for this year.
Yeah, Seth.
But it also said where people were from, not where people actually live today on the map. And I was confused. I put where I live since I came from Oklahoma to come to the convention.
Cool.
I put Oklahoma.
Yeah.
I'm from New York originally, so I put Oklahoma.
No, where you live and where are you, point A to point B to get here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Juan Jose here in the second row is from Chile, for example. You came strictly for the pinball show, right? Of course.
Yeah.
He's not interested in the Bluegrass Festival in the city, by the way. Chile.
Chile.
South America.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, you guys don't know me. I came from Los Angeles. I talked to you, and I'll talk to you afterwards the show. I have a way I think you could get some donations, some serious ones. I have an idea.
All right. That'd be great.
You might think I'm crazy, but we'll talk about that afterwards.
Okay.
You know, I guess what the problem is, you're talking Northern California. We got 40 million people alone in Southern California. There's a problem in Southern California, and I'll tell you. I went to a pinball show in Las Vegas 5 years ago. The guys here put it on. I went a couple of years, disappeared. I asked the guys anything going on. The guy never got back to me. I Googled you to get to the show. I found you on Google, and you know me. I called and said, you forgot to put the prices on the on the deal. So, but the whole point is, you know, I mean, it's so popular, like you say. I sold a pinball book by Roger Sharp for $135 in Japan. You know, we're talking international here. And I mean, I know, you're little, you know, you just can't explode. But there's so many ideas, and you know, you're talking about a man from Chile found this. I can see this thing getting 10,000 people in 2 or 3 years is not a problem.
Yeah.
That's just, I mean, with not doing a lot. But, I mean, you can't spend a bunch for advertising, but... I don't know why the word in Southern California never came out. I mean, I know you're here and you're talking Bay, and I don't blame it because, you know, I went to Las Vegas to play pinball machines, probably the only coin drop in the entire world that's legal because it's Vegas. which you obviously know the museum.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, I just wanted to, just to familiarize, I don't know, but I can see this thing going much, much bigger.
I can too.
And I didn't go crazy. I Googled it and accidentally found this expo. I would have been happy the last 4 years if I found it. And if other people know when the board got out, sometimes it's word of mouth. You know, a lot of people are in disturbance. I just played pinball. I like the early machines. I played on the bike in Long Beach when I was a kid. Give me the 50 machines, you can have the rest. Nobody wants them. I love them. I got a whole load of myself. You know, everybody's got their own thing. But there's a lot of ideas, I think, that can make you more profitable, I think. And I don't have all the answers. But like I said, I've got a couple of them.
Yeah, love to talk. What's your name?
Thurston.
Okay.
Yeah, you can't miss
out. Okay.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. I think we're just about out of time.
But again, thank you for coming. Thank you for your interest. And most of all, thank you for your continued support of the Pacific Pinball Museum and certainly for our expo here. We're really looking forward to your help and enjoy the show.
Yeah. One last thing. If you see anybody in an orange shirt that says pinball staff, go up and pat them on the back and tell them thanks. Because they're the ones that, you know,
absolutely.
It just doesn't happen without a lot of support. Thanks.
Thank you.